Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're doing a special program today, starting off with the latest on anti-aging, anti-inflammation information that can help a lot of people because of all the soreness and muscle aches and pains, migraines, and also how we can better understand antibodies in the body and how to stimulate them and what they actually do. New information. Always some cutting-edge sources, always quality independent sources. Then the rest of the program will be devoted to a series of commentaries. I'm concerned by what I see, and I want to share my concerns with this audience. I believe that liberalism, as it historically served the needs of the middle class, the working class, the people who did not have a voice, Lou Hill created a network, the Pacifica Network, for those who are voiceless. And I believe that those people today are frustrated and angry. I believe what we are seeing is the transformation of the liberal class into the neoliberal class. And it's been almost a seamless transformation. My commentary will be on that subject. And I will give you specific examples of what is right in front of us, but unless you step back and examine it carefully and objectively and honestly, you won't realize how the vast majority of people claiming, whether it's in the media or academia or in the body politic, that they're there for our interest, are not. In fact, they're there for their own interest and the interest of those who put them in power and keep them in power. So at a certain point, there is an awakening. There is a paradigm shift in consciousness. We've been talking about this paradigm shift and the what was called the Aquarian Conspiracy with Marilyn Ferguson's very insightful work, but she was way ahead of her time, as well as Dr. Kahn and others who were talking about what happens when one day, as a country, we awaken. Well, I believe we are now awakening. I believe that had we awakened earlier, that the president would be Jill Stein, or before her, Rocky Anderson, before her, Ralph Nader. I also believe that even those who are awakening today, the millennials, saw this, understood it better than their senior citizen family members. And as a result, they wanted Bernie Sanders, a good choice. He would have made a far better president than any of the presidents we had in the last 32 years. But he was not allowed to show the direction a country could go in when it had new mandates and a whole vital young audience behind it. He was cheated out of that. It's unfortunate how he acquiesced. And that disappointment rang through the entire millennial generation who did not, as it turns out, vote for Hillary Clinton. But instead of being honest about why she lost, she surrounded herself with her own support system, those who benefit from a corporate Democrat or corporate liberal control system. I will show you the underbelly of that corporate liberal system. Today, I will also share commentaries from Max Fort from Zero Anthropology in the Dying Days of Liberalism. If time permits, from The Intercept, from Glenn Greenwald, Trump's ban is a culmination of a war on terror mentality, but still uniquely shameful. From Mike Whitney, Double Standards. Where were the liberal protesters during Obama's wars? And more. I will also share some unique audio clips that you have not heard before and give you a perspective of what we can do. My intent is not to anger people, rather to awaken in them to a potential to have real change. Unlike others, I do not believe that either party, Democrat or Republican, can be reformed, because there's just too much entrenched power and money in the existing system. So building new, grassroots, multicultural, multi-ideas in parties, that is the future. I'll share some ideas that we could get working on immediately, and to all the women who marched and then went home I'm hopeful that the vast majority of those women and the men that support them could focus their energies at least maybe 6 hours a week on issues that could make a difference if they apply on a daily basis, or 6 hours a week, but if they keep their focus on a daily basis to these issues. I'll share some ideas on that as well. So we have an extraordinarily important program today. Let us begin. And we always begin with the latest on health and healing. This is from Ohio State University, published in the Journal of Bone and Mineral Research. What they found was that an anti-inflammatory diet, which, quote, tends to be high in vegetables, fruits, fish, and whole grains, could boost bone health and prevent fractures in some women. And researchers examined data from the landmark Women's Health Initiative to compare levels of inflammatory elements in the diet to bone mineral density and fractures, and found new associations between food and bone health. So what it means in lay language is that women with the least inflammatory diets, that means a plant-based healthy diet, lost the least amount of bone density during a six-year period. Now, this is a new study, but it's not a unique study. I remember back in the early 70s doing research on the Japanese and Chinese diet and finding that they had very little osteoporosis. Women in Japan had so few symptoms of menopause that it was not even considered a condition there, but just a normal aging process. And the reason is simple. They have a high amount of probiotics in their diet from fermented miso. They also have a lot of root vegetables, sea vegetables, and fruits in the diet, many that we do not have in our society. In fact, some of the so-called superfoods that we have become popular in the past 15 years, they've been using for centuries. And also, they work a great deal. Obesity is very rare. The family unit's very important. Just doing simple things like a traditional bath at night, and where a person massages your head and back and neck to help relieve the stress. When was the last time the average American family spent a meal together, relaxed together, did some meditation together? We don't do those things. And, of course, we assume that there's no consequence. But look at the societies that do those things, and you'll see that they're living longer and healthier lives. So get rid of the inflammatory agents in your diet and strengthen your bones, because in kale and in sea vegetables, you have up to 10 times more calcium by dry weight than you do in milk. And you also have the other minerals like boron and manganese and silica and calcium and magnesium, all essential for the formation of new bone. Dairy does have calcium, but it doesn't have the other minerals. It's highly allergenic, and it does not prevent osteoporosis. In fact, I wrote about this a long time ago, and I just wanted to see what the latest studies show, and they're still confirming that the five nations on the planet, the United States is one, and Great Britain, United Kingdom is a second, that consume the most dairy have the most osteoporosis. And yet we were told it builds strong bones. That is simply a lie. From College London, University College London, comes a study on Nigella sativa, better known as black cumin. And what they have found is that it can help control asthma and lung function. And that's a big deal if it's able to open up the airwaves, and it does. It's a little black seed. It's been used extensively in traditional medicine in Middle Eastern and Asian countries for the treatment of the immune system and inflammatory disorders. Well, this new study published in the peer-reviewed Phytotherapy Research found that 1 gram per day of the oil for 4 weeks led to significant improvements in asthma control, quote, and a remarkable reduction of peripheral blood esophageal count. And what's important is that that particular cell plays a major role in asthma inflammation. and the blood count is considered to be a vital biomarker for asthma trials. So this was a randomized, placebo-controlled, double-blind study that showed, quote, a significant reduction of the blood eosinophil by the black cumin seed oil. In lay language, it means it simply brings down the inflammation in the lungs, allowing a person to breathe deeper. Now, you may think, well, how much is a gram of oil per day? It's a tiny amount. Remember, it's 20.35 grams to an ounce. So this is 1/28. 1/28 of an ounce. It's a small amount to take. We're not talking about a lot. In fact, very little. And it can turn off inflammation in the lungs, but it also turns off inflammation in the brain, turns off inflammation in the heart, and in the muscles. From the European Cancer Organization, a new study that shows that diabetes and or being in a bad way with diabetes can also be an early warning sign for pancreatic cancer, and especially when people are deteriorating. When you start getting neuropathy, when you're starting to lose vision, when you're starting to get sores and ulcers, that's when you're in a declining situation. And we're talking about millions of people in the United States with pre or diabetic conditions. So it's just a heads up. If you exercise daily, twice a day, if you get rid of all the sugars and processed carbohydrates and animal proteins, if you start taking a healthy plant-based diet with about 50 grams of fiber a day, if you take a 50 milligram B-complex, and if you take vitamin C throughout the day, and if you juice green vegetable juices throughout the day, and you take your coenzyme Q10 and vitamin E, you can substantially overcome diabetes. You can be cured of it. And that means you're less likely to get pancreatic cancer. Also, there's new research from the Technical University of Munich that shows that the antibodies are messengers in the nervous system. Now, this is a little complicated, but I'll put it into lay language. Antibodies are able to activate human nerve cells within milliseconds, and hence they modify their function. That is the surprising conclusion of a study carried out at Human Biology at the Technical University of Munich, and this knowledge improves our understanding of illnesses that accompany certain types of cancer, above all severe intestinal malfunctions. And functional disorders in your organs that manifest in conjunction with tumors are a part of this. And these syndromes are not caused by the primary tumor itself, but are instead frequently a result of the body's autoimmune reaction. And in such cases, the person's own antibodies turn against their own cells and attack them. And one of these functional disorders is paralysis of the intestinal tract. For example, there's an intestinal pseudo-abdominal obstruction, and it makes it difficult for patients to obtain the nutrients and calories they require from their diet. They begin to waste away, what is called cachexia. And this so-called anti-Hugh syndrome is a type of a syndrome often associated with atonic gut. And this is where your antibodies come in. Now, again, I realize this is a little complicated, but let me just make it a gross oversimplification. If we're eating an unhealthy diet, if we do not have enough fiber, if we don't have enough enzymes, which are the catalysts of life, just imagine an enzyme as a cylinder in your car. Then what happens is when we become sick, the body does not have enough of an immune response to stop whatever the pathogen is, whether it's a cancer cell, bacteria, virus, parasite, etc. And so it adapts to it. It adapts with fatigue. It adapts with local infections. And generally where these local and focal infections are, frequently that's where you have massive inflammation. Now the body's not equipped enough. It doesn't have enough power within itself to turn off the inflammation, to fight the foreign agent, and to get you well. And that's why people who are sick continue to eat bad food and drink bad beverages are only exacerbating it, because what they have now found is that the body is able to respond to antibodies in both a positive and destructive way. So when you have a lot of enzymes in the diet, and there's your fresh juices, blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, carrot juice, all these juices flood the body with positive anti-inflammatory responses, nutrients, and you get a positive antibody response. But when you're eating junk food, drinking alcohol, then you create negative antibodies. And the negative antibodies then cause an overreaction of the immune system. And now you're depleted. Your adrenals are depleted. Your immune system is overwhelming the body's natural systems. So clean up the body, change the nature of the enzymes, and you don't have this grid and lock in the intestines then. I can't tell you how many thousands of people I've counseled who they had terrible issues with their intestines, especially people with cancer, and you get start getting the healthy enzymes in, the probiotics in, the fiber in, the right nutrients in, and lo and behold, the intestines open up, they start to absorb their nutrients, they start to feel better. That's why it's so important to have healthy input so that the enzymes don't end up creating a negative reaction in your body. And by the way, from the University of Washington, chronic sleep deprivation, and a lot of Americans don't have good night's sleep, suppresses the immune system. Now, many people report getting sick when they don't get enough sleep. A new study helps explain why. Researchers took blood samples from a group of identical twins with different sleep patterns and discovered that the twin with the shortest sleep duration had a depressed immune system compared with his or her sibling, and they're published in the peer-reviewed journal Sleep. Quote, "What we show is that the immune system functions best when it gets enough sleep. 7 or more hours of sleep is recommended for optimal health." And a unique feature of the study was to employ identical twins in order to control for the large genetic determinant to human sleep duration. And researchers say genetics accounts for about 31 to 55% of sleep duration and behavior. And I believe it's far less. And I believe that conditioning really is most of that, because I've seen so many people, when they change their habits, also change the way they sleep. And finally, from McMaster University in Ontario, a lack of exercise invites dementia. So we're not exercising as a society. Those who do exercise are doing it well and benefiting, but the vast majority of Americans don't exercise. And what happens is that when you're not exercising and you're engaged in a sedentary lifestyle, you're creating the same risk of developing dementia as those who carry the APOE gene mutation, which increases the chance of developing dementia. Conversely, people who exercised appeared to have lower odds of developing dementia than those who didn't. This was a 5-year study. Quote, "Being inactive may completely negate the protective effects of a healthy set of genes. So, if you want to live a longer life, according to this article published in Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, exercise. My suggestion, twice a day, about a half hour in the morning, half hour in the evening would be fine." I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment with our commentaries. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Noll. For the remainder of our program today, this is a look at the consequences of the neoliberal agenda. I believe that all people, if they looked at the best that liberalism has been in the past, would agree that it would suit so many people well if we had legislators who actually used this as a way of helping us today. When you consider that 2/3 of all people living in the United States are living just above, at, or below the poverty line, when we have between 2.5 to 3 million people living on less than $2 a day, That is the same standard that we find in over 3 billion people around the world in the poorest countries and the poorest people in those countries. And yet we have it here. We have almost 17 million hungry children in the United States, 2.4 million homeless children in the United States. And yet there is no discussion, no legislation, no effort, no demonstrations, no marches, no editorials on their behalf in the mainstream media, and very little in the alternative. How did we get here? What can we learn from our recent experiences? I want to share some insights now of what it means and why I believe that we are better than what we have led the world to believe, especially when it comes to this model that everybody is professing that we should be living by, and try to have a reasonable conversation with a person who believes in only one ideology and excludes any conversation or the validity of anyone else's beliefs. The conversation doesn't go very far. I believe it's a sight to behold. Again, I'm speaking for myself. I'm also speaking on behalf of Max Forte and Zero Anthropology on this, because these are the dying days. And I believe that we're in a countdown. Now, last week on Thursday, I did a program with a professor emeritus, which is the highest distinction and achievement you can have within academia, because it shows that you have created a legacy. You have created something remarkable, unique, that is your signature work. And when we had Professor Guy McPherson on from Belize, and by the way, we edited the first 9 minutes where he was not able to be understood and just extended the program a little longer so you can hear the whole program now without any distortion. He said, at best, we have about 10 years. A lot of people did not fully understood that and thought the world would end in 10 years. No, that's not what will happen. The countdown has already been going on. All you have to do is look around you, and you'll see unique events. If you were down in Louisiana right now today, you would see at least 200,000 homes severely damaged enough that people will never be able to move back in there, and no flood money, insurance money to help them rebuild. And now the mold will take over, and it'll be too contaminated for them to move in. When was that in the news last? When was the last time someone was down there showing you their suffering? What has the government done to help them? How about nothing? How about Fukushima? Now, unless I miss something, if you're spilling 100,000 tons of water a day into the ocean, totally polluted with radiation, and you've created at least a 2,000-mile completely polluted area where no fish can live and stay healthy, and no sea vegetable can live and stay healthy, and it's still going on, and there's no fix in sight, that should be in our news. We should have had a world effort to stop that pollution, because the ocean belongs not to Japan, but to the whole world, and not a single thing, not a single mention of it anymore. It had its news cycle, and it is gone. But isn't it on everyone's best interest to clean up the oceans, the rivers, the sky, our soil, to preserve our soil, to enrich it? Yes, it is. Yet you wouldn't know that. Well, McPherson was saying, once the Arctic ice is gone, where the water is no longer reflecting with the ice on the water back into the solar system, then that water is free of ice. The sun's rays go into the water, hit the bottom, heat it up. Methane is released, more methane than what we've had in the last 100 years could be released in 2 or 3 years. That would increase the temperature, and that temperature in and of itself would not cause any mass die-off of people as such, but rather it causes the soil no longer to be plantable. It causes species that we're losing 200 a day to be accelerated. It will change the warmth of the ocean, which changes plankton, which changes the food chain, including the reefs and the barrier reefs that hundreds of billions of sea creatures feed off of. And then the larger creatures feed off the smaller. It changes all that, and you'll have massive die-off. Right now, we have enough food being grown in the United States, but it's not uniform, and we should. Long ago, we should have started agriculture programs in all 50 states. We do not. We rely upon California, Florida, Texas, and our breadbasket for most of our produce. That's not going to be possible in the very near future. Kansas and other cities, states will not be able to have climate controllability. As a result, the ground will overheat, seeds will not germinate, and are over flood with too much rain, and then they'll rot. As a result, initially, people who can afford it will simply pay more for food from someplace else in the United States or some other country. Because in all countries of the world where they have food that they can export, they do not first think about their own citizens. Instead, they think of where the market is, where they can profit, and that's where the food goes. So people who have money will always be the last to be impacted. But it depends upon where they live, because even the richest of the rich will be impacted if any environmental disasters occur, and I believe they will, as do others, within the next 5 years. We're in feedback loops. We have over 40 different feedback loops going on simultaneously. But ask the average person about any of these feedback loops, and I dare you to get two of them right. And we have 40, and they're all working synergistically. So it's not as if we have one problem to face. We're not able to face even one problem, let alone 40 problems. So as a result, we live in denial. And it doesn't matter who's in power, Democrat or Republican, the liberal or conservative, everyone's in denial. And the only time you hear anything is when it's a token effort, not meant to actually change anything. And that's what we have to accept. So that's why I say these are dying days. And I also believe it's a dying day for liberalism, and that's unfortunate. It was inherited from the 19th century. What a thing it is to watch one of the dominant cornerstone ideologies of the international system, which has strutted its stuff with such swagger and certainty since the end of the Cold War, finally fall face forward into a dustbin of history. It has fallen with the same force as if shoved from behind by a stampeding mob, although its defenders will claim that there were mere mistakes were made, as if they accidentally slipped on history's largest ever banana peel. And what a scene. Who would have expected such a lack of dignity, such a pathetic hysteria, such baseless smears, such empty threats coming from those who otherwise elaborately preen themselves as gallant statespersons, who spoke as if they had cornered the market on reason and ethics and vitalism. While the fall could have been worse, there has not been an absence of violence, threats, boycotts, and even calls for treason designed to destabilize our current government. Now, I believe in the power of demonstrations, as I've led hundreds and have led movements, many. I also know that one must use reason in all such efforts, and you must have something concrete, viable, that can be implemented at the local level to empower people about the legitimacy of change that they're a part of. They're owning that change, and therefore that vitalism that is shared between the people who are being a victim of someone's efforts and then regaining their sense of freedom by working with other people is essential. And therefore, I hope that when people are justifiably angry at what this new president is doing, they also realize that had Hillary Clinton been elected, it would have actually been worse, hard as that is to imagine. And I'll get into that a little later. But neither of these parties are the answer. And they haven't been, unless you're one of the very exclusive members of their insiders group. Liberal democracy has been reduced to a shell, more a name than a fact that deserves the name. For many years, liberalism has been liberal authoritarianism, or post-liberalism, or neoliberalism, with a high elitist disdain for democracy and a fear of the masses everywhere. But maybe I'm remiss. When was the last time you saw the leaders of this movement living amongst the people, vacationing with the people, eating the restaurants of the people, going to a softball game with the people? No, the people in power do all they can to solidify their membership in the elitist groups by going to their unique getaways, living in gated communities where only they can afford to be, and their skyscrapers, and joining exclusive clubs. So at the one hand, they say, I'm with you. And on the other, we never see them until they won our vote. Promises, promises, promises. Promises of inclusion, promises of fairness, promises of welfare were replaced by sensitive-sounding rhetorical tricks and tokenism, moral narcissism, virtue signaling, identity politics, and building patchwork quilts of diversity were the order of the day. Protests were encouraged abroad against target nations in the name of democracy promotion. But at home, protests were shut down by an always more militarized police. Nations around the world were lectured about transparency and accountability. But at home, it was all but mass surveillance, domestic espionage, and a crackdown on whistleblowers. If you spoke out against anyone in power, you were going to be targeted, and in some cases, jailed. Liberal leaders claimed to be upholders of peace and order while multiplying the number of wars. Obama himself is personally responsible for the killing of tens of thousands of innocent civilians. Look at Libya, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan. Look at the drones in Mali and the Sudan. In 2006 alone, the United States dropped 72 bombs every 24 hours in wars in seven Muslim countries. The question is, how did that work out building a better relationship with Muslims? Obama oversaw the rapid acceleration of wealth transfer and heightened domestic poverty. And then he is praised by pseudo-left liberal scholars and writers for having governed well and doing so with a professional, graceful demeanor. The North American and European left, which made its peace and came to a bargain with liberal imperialism, sinks with those who in the end rewarded them with so little. Once again, leftist socialist imperial results in failure as it lays the foundation for its replacement. So it's no small thing that has fallen here. Not merely the defeat of Hillary Clinton and Americans rejecting Obama's legacy. We are dealing with a series of institutions, an expert class, the technocrats I've called them for a long time, in a network of politicians and corporate alliances that is being shaken beyond repair. We are in the earliest days of a historical transition. So it's not clear what is coming next, and the labels that have been proliferating demonstrate confusion and uncertainty, populism, nativism, nationalism, etc. We can start to witness the fact that as part of the defeat of the expert class, U.S. anthropology exercising its hegemony on an international scale will not be spared either. Surely liberalism will not disappear outright. That's not going to happen, not instantly. Ideas don't ever really die. They're just archived. Liberalism will remain available in text on library bookshelves, will be remembered and defended by its living upholders, and specific elements of its vocabulary may live on. Some will try to revive the liberal political project, and in some quarters it will even look as if it's making a comeback. But such efforts will be isolated and relatively short-lived. What Francis Fukuyama hailed as the end of history ended up being more of a swan song for liberalism, though nowhere near as beautiful. If, as the dominant historiological element would have it, communism failed, glad for that, then liberalism would be next. Despite every labored effort to misappropriate the meaning of fascism and assign it just exclusively to Trump, fascism is also not part of a viable movement and cannot be. And that's good news. Rather than the end of ideology, it looks more like the opening to something new. No wonder so many people are now looking at the current debates and saying the debate should not be about left and right. That's an old debate. By those who are conservative or liberal, that's an older debate. No, we should be talking about globalism. We should be talking about nationalism. We should be talking about what really benefits the planet and each of us to live in harmony and peace with our neighbors and respect life, irrespective of the other person's background and race, ethnicity. Those should not be determinants in any of our future discussions, as they have been exclusively the backroom conversation, but never voiced publicly. The Democrats, a party that tied its fortunes to those of liberalism, seems lost in a spiral of denying responsibility for its electoral defeat, coupled with a denial of reality. Party leaders brushed aside, reflecting on how they pushed forward such a severely flawed candidate as Hillary Clinton, as if she were some sort of natural choice at the apex of an evolutionary process whose final point had been foretold and pushed her forward, whether people liked her or not. So at the end of the day, people did not like her. Many people did not like her. We're not just discussing those that you could say were radicalized and right of spectrum. You can say an awful lot of young people who supported Bernie's did not like her. You could say a lot of independents who had come to a decision after looking carefully at what the Clinton body politic looked like did not like her. You could see a lot of people who were educated enough to see that she was responsible for the destruction of Libya and the invasion of Honduras, or its coup that overturned a democratically elected government and ousted a president who wanted nothing more than to allow citizens back onto lands that they had once inhabited. No. To suggest that tens of millions of people did not like the Clintons or the Bushes or Obama was not because they were racist or homophobic or they were crazy or that they were undesirable. No, these were people with a conscious mind who had done their homework and came to their own decision. For the first time in a long time, we were not suffering from complete denial of groupthink and manipulation. And that's how it was. Rather than deal with the facts of their defeat, within days the Democrats were spinning tales of Russian hacking and Russian-orchestrated fake news. They didn't lose to Donald Trump. No, they lost to Vladimir Putin. Once again, how the Democrats lost explained why they had to lose. This was a melodramatic escalation of the Clinton campaign's very dangerous threats against Russia, which entailed setting in motion a new Cold War. And you realize, I've made this comment many times, in Washington, D.C., there's more than 200,000 companies, corporations, and consultants working in just the military-industrial complex. They needed Clinton. Did it occur to anyone that if she was considered such a viable candidate by the entire Wall Street community, the entire pharmaceutical community, the entire agricultural community, including Monsanto and DuPont, the entire Fortune 500 of all the leading tax-avoiding corporations in America, the entire military-industrial complex, the entire medical-industrial complex, if everyone in power in the 1.1% of people said, yes, she is our candidate, then why in the hell was she your candidate? That should have told you something. It should have told you she is a bot and paid for just like Obama, just like all the other presidents clear back, but not including Dwight Eisenhower and FDR. They were influenced, but not in the pocket. But we chose not to believe that. We chose to believe in a person's statements instead of looking at what they had actually done. And it's time now for us to take an honest look. We would have a new Cold War. We would have NATO barking now at Russia. Boy, wars are profitable. We will escalate. The Democrats today act like the new Joe McCarthy on a witch hunt for traitors, spinning one conspiracy theory after another, while their media cronies generate a deluge of fabrications while claiming to counter fake news. Want an example of this? Look at CNN, look at MSNBC and the talking clowns there. Look at people who choose to be called journalists but have done nothing that independently verifies that they are willing to take on anyone in finding the truth. These people act more like lapdogs than they do responsible journalists. And responsible journalists are not the ones that they promote. And that's unfortunate, but it's the truth of it. No, what we have today is Obama asked to be taken seriously. And because people liked his personality and people liked his race and people liked his background. They assumed that he should be taken seriously. So which part of it should we take seriously? That he is the president of peace and then does more bombing of more countries than any other president in American history? Or that he is for transparency and creates more secrecy and top secret and no production of the Freedom of Information Act requests for most of the categories of any other president? And those who say, tell the truth and we will protect you, and then prosecutes and puts in prison under the Espionage Act from 1917, more whistleblowers. Everything he said, he did just the opposite. And for those of us who were watching, we called it. For those who were enamored, they accepted it. So here we are. So when Wikipedia said it wasn't the Russians who gave us the material, he stood on his record of 10 years of never having a single document be challenged for its accuracy. But instead of looking at the truth that these were scandalous and illegal actions that were being revealed through all the different email leaks, not just the Podesta ones, it was kill the messenger, discredit the messenger, blame it on Russia. And there was always the clowns in Congress like Lindsey from the Carolinas and also John McCain. Obama claimed his administration was scandal-free, and it was not. All he had were an orchestra of sycophantic journalists. One face told the public that the Podesta email published by WikiLeaks were mere titbits of gossip and non-essential. Later, they would say, oh, no, WikiLeaks was altered the course of election. But then that is Obama, with his consistent inconsistencies, the bifurcated messaging, the two faces alternating in almost equal speech. He is not nuanced. There's not complexity. He is just dishonest and wrong. And the grand failure to convince manifested in other critical ways as well. Hollywood was involved in at least three rounds of celebrity video compilations, were often in the most urgent and heartfelt tones that professional paid fakers can muster. Viewers were instructed on the correct moral choice. The person who demonized millions of voters as deplorables, as basement dwellers, as super predators, the same person responsible for pushing the destruction of the Libyan state with all the aftermath of terrorism across North Africa, a refugee outflow and civil war that has lasted years, a proven track record of creating danger, hectoring by Hollywood actors, and even worse, their junior counterparts on MTV failed miserably because more younger people were aware because of what Bernie Sanders was sharing and what the mainstream media had missed, but the internet had not. The mainstream media, the Clinton campaign, were tone deaf. They thought just more of the same from the past. No, you got a younger generation that's much faster at getting information and much better able to assimilate that, and they were by the millions lining up behind Bernie. Had there not been the Democratic National Committee illegally and unethically and immorally interfering, Bernie Sanders would have been present today because he would have beaten Donald Trump handily. Not only did Hollywood fail, but so did most of the mainstream media, which themselves face plunging levels of public trust. Not just the media, but an array of polling firms, public relations agencies, professional advertisers, and strategic communications consultants all failed as badly, and this in the very society that invented public relations. Hillary Clinton fashioned herself as a leader in soft power, and here was the entire architecture of soft power foundering, not just abroad, but at home of all places. And so there it is. All of the corporate donors, the billions of dollars, the most expensive election in history, all of the people lining up behind her from corporate America. We've never had anyone like that in American history who had such a lopsided support system. But the support system should have told us something. If these are my friends, if these are the people who want me elected, wow, what does that say? And that does not take any great nuance or depth to understand that. But we could have looked differently. Take a look at Hillary Clinton's last book. stronger together. Quote from the New York Times, it sold just 2,912 copies in its first week on sale. And by the way, as the author of more than 100 books and over 70 bestsellers, what happens in the first week of general release is generally it's going to account for about a third of the total number of copies sold. And here's what the Times says, quote, the sales figure firmly makes the book what the publishing industry would consider a flop. So why didn't anyone pay attention that maybe it wasn't the Clintons that and what they stood for that was needed? And no one was willing to look for the truth. And no one was looking at how many people had lost their job and was no longer considered in the workforce. Nobody was willing to look at what it was like to live in the homes if you're a senior citizen and you don't have enough money to pay for your mortgage or rent and medicine and food. No one was willing to look at what it means to graduate from college and not have a job or have a job that pays or is a job in the area of your expertise. No. No platitudes and nothing more. But the Democrats were not willing to use the power they had. So let me explain where I believe the Democrats and the liberals have failed. We know how the Republicans have failed, but we're not willing to be honest about how the liberal class failed. Let me now share with you, for the remainder of this discussion, how the liberals failed on the economy. They have not challenged NAFTA, GATT, the World Trade Organization, and they fully supported the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They did not try to repeal the Glass-Steagall Act. They largely were responsible for TARP payments to banks. And by the way, how much money do you think that under Clinton, it started at the end of Bush, but it was under Obama and all of the liberal class that was around him, how much did they give to the banks? They gave you nothing. They gave students nothing. To people losing their homes, they gave nothing. To small businesses, they gave not a penny. But to their friends, $29.6 trillion. That's how much they bailed them out. Those are actual statistics, and I have all the documentation. I can tell you, for example, from the best studies that have been done, and these are very qualified, from the University of Missouri, by the way, where Bill Black teaches, they reviewed all of the $29 trillion in bailout payments, all were broken down, and here's the problem. People were looking for one amount, and they might have found an amount of $800 billion or $2 trillion. They weren't looking under the different initials, like the CBLS, or the AIA/ALI, or the CPFF, or the TALF, etc. Some examples under the TALF handouts, $3.8 trillion. $1.9 trillion was given to foreign institutions, including Barclays, Royal Bank of Scotland Group, and the Bank of Scotland. Under the CBLS giveaways, the European Central Bank received $8 trillion. Have you ever heard anyone at any time in any media tell you that? Let me put that in perspective. $8 trillion we gave to a corrupt organization, the European Central Bank, for a completely corrupt European Union, and that could have rebuilt all of our infrastructures. It could have completely de-ghettoized all of America. It could have put over 20 million Americans back to work at a living wage. It could have created universal health care, and it could have created universal free education in public institutions. Instead, secretly, we gave $8 trillion to the European Central Bank, a completely disgusting organization. Merrill Lynch, $2 trillion. Citigroup, $2 trillion. Morgan Stanley, $1.9 trillion. Bank of America, $640 billion. That's under the PDCF. But the largest recipients of the trillions came under the CBLS handouts. Remember, each handout had its own accounting, and therefore none of it was collected together. Citigroup, $2.6 trillion. Merrill Lynch, $2.4 trillion. Morgan Stanley, $2.2 trillion. AIG, $1 trillion. Barclays, $1 trillion. Bank of America, $1 trillion. PNB, Paribas in France, $1 trillion. Goldman Sachs, $995 billion. Credit Suisse, $772 billion. Deutsche Bank, $771 billion. Altogether, there is your total that I was referring to, which we were not told, because if we were told that we're giving nearly $30 trillion, the most in world history, to people that have done nothing but commit crimes, every one of the organizations I just mentioned that we gave money to has been found guilty multiple times of illegal activity and fined. So why are we keeping in business, instead of taking out of business, criminal organizations? Because they're all connected to those in power. So that's what I mean about we did not allow any of the big banks to fail. And also, we failed to introduce legislation, with the exception of a couple ill-supported attempts to bring about single-payer health care. Long ago, we could have had one single-payer health care and had none of these problems, but that was not profitable to the pharmaceutical industry that would have had its prices controlled, the insurance industry that receives $1 trillion a year for its management of these systems, and the for-profit hospitals, where you would be charged $1,000 for a $1 bag of saline solution. Nope. It could have been done. The liberal class supported the conservatives, who do everything wrong. Nothing do they do right. Also, they allowed lobbying to continue unabated. They did not attack ALEKS, the American Legislative Exchange Council, for 35 years of interfering in state politics by writing over 25,000 laws that were passed in those legislatures as if it were their own undertaking by the legislator instead of the 200 to 250 corporations that are behind it. They did nothing to break up the big banks. There was no concerted effort to attack human rights issues behind commodity trading. There was monopolistic practices. They only spoke rhetorically of them. But over the decades, the industries have consolidated themselves into monolithic cartels without adversaries. There's no competition in the marketplace anymore. Now, that's just on the economy. Now, let's see how the liberals completely undermine the military and defense. They continue to support and fund the Patriot Act. They consistently voted favorably for defense budget increases, every single one. They, including Bernie Sanders on that, they permitted the National Defense Authorization Act to go forward with strong contestation. There was lame efforts to challenge U.S. drone program and executive assassination policies. They failed to reopen the 9/11 investigation, even though the lawyer heading the 9/11 investigation and two of the heads of the 9/11 investigation said that it was flawed. There was no push or effort for a thorough investigation into the legitimacy of the war on terror, as currently defined and being acted upon. There was no congressional outrage on U.S. involvement in Libya, the Ukraine, or Honduras regime change. They were impotent in confronting Israel war crimes in Gaza and human rights abuses in the West Bank. That was all because AIPAC got them to sign letters of alliance with Israel. Where was the courage there? There was no formidable challenge to U.S.-Saudi relationships and weapon sales. There was allowing a new Cold War with Russia to proceed unchallenged. There was no effort to downsize our military overreach around the world with 900 bases. They were mute on renewing nuclear weapons buildup, a move to start a new round with over $1 trillion. They supported surveillance, spying, and warrantless wiretappings all the while. And that's just on some of the most important issues. But there were many more also that they did not address and should have. For example, they should have both liberals and conservatives, federal investigators, would not go after the others who had committed crimes in office. For example, there's major crimes against humanity that the Clintons engaged in, that the Bush decided not to do, that the Bushes engaged in, that Obama decided not to focus on, and that Obama did that no one will focus on in the future. They were moot on the campaign finance reform. What we should have, if we were really civilized, is we would have anyone could run for office, a three-month campaign, no private financing whatsoever, do it by lottery. People lay out their policies on different issues by lottery. They debate. We have a chance to see who we believe is most qualified, and that's who should be elected. They did nothing on Citizens United. They could have. They completely failed on tackling health care, moving towards single payer. They did not regulate big pharma. They did not stop the vaccine exemptions on responsibility for bad vaccines. They could have. They developed an anti-science program because they were pro-GMOs and pro-vaccines. They fast-tracked both, and they shouldn't have. There was an inability to be honest about the real unemployment in the nation. They kept these sham figures in order to give a phony sense of healthy domestic economy when it's actually closer to 24% minimum unemployment. There was no attempts at prison reform. We still had the death penalty. There was a failure to deal with national legalization policy on marijuana, which keeps the industrial prison complex rolling in money. There was no effort to push for congressional reevaluation of our 40-plus years of wars on drugs. They allowed home foreclosure to continue to benefit the lenders. There was no effort to stop home foreclosures. They failed to tackle the problem of student loan debt, which continues to grow. There was far too little being done to deal with transitioning the renewable clean energies to confront climate change. Instead, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and the others supported gas hydrofracking, nuclear, and oil and coal. There was no outrage at the years of U.S. backing of international treaties and then backing out of them and all the human rights abuses that were occurring and then using the military to intervene in countries. There was no effort to improve laws that protect whistleblowers, just the opposite. There was a failure to tackle educational reform. Just look at other nations that have much smarter kids, much healthier kids than we do for models that work. Ours don't. There was no attempt to reverse the Bush's bankruptcy laws. No serious attempt to review and change subsidy policies for corporate America. Corporate America and the conservatives have historically said we don't like welfare, and yet they were the largest recipients of welfare, corporate welfare. And so there it is, some of the issues. I do not have time for more of these issues, but it gives you an idea that we need a whole new understanding of our responsibility as individuals and groups to pull ourselves away from the corporate Republican, the corporate Democrat, the liberal and conservative communities, and to begin to organize ourselves on more spiritual, humanistic, and progressive values at the local level. We have to get off their grid. We have to stop putting our money in their banks, using their credit cards, buying their clothes, eating their food, watching their media. And we have to make our own day-to-day lives more significant than the outcome of a Super Bowl. We have to break our addiction, not just to drugs and alcohol and smoking and sugar, but in reality TV, but to our comforts. We have to realize that those we trusted, those we empowered, those we gave everything to, took it all, and there was no trickle down of anything except contempt for us. These are my thoughts, and I stand behind them. I'm Gary Noll, and I want to thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Does the current dire state of the economy have you totally upset and confused? There are solutions.